Patricia Camilleri, Director of the Communications and Alumni Relations Office here at the University of Malta. In this series called Research Matters, I shall be discussing the many research projects undertaken by the university's academics from all fields of study. I'm delighted to have with me today Professor Horatio Vella. Professor Vella was born in Pietà, here in Malta, and raised in Slima. He first studied at the Archbishop's Seminary in Floriana, then moved to the UK and continued his education there before returning in the early 70s. He graduated in Classics, BA Honours, MA, PhD, and taught at the universities of Rhodesia, now known as Zimbabwe, of course, Malawi, and in Malta from 1989. He was also external examiner for 2 years for the University of Malawi in the 80s, and he helped to reintroduce the study of Latin and Greek at the University of Malta when he started lecturing here in 1989. His research interests are various. He's interested in Maltese history, Greek and Latin meter, Greek mythology, Greek religion, paleography, epigraphy, archival, and epic. He's published a number of articles on Virgil and Homer, about which I hope we shall be speaking, and he has reorganized 3 archives in Malta and Gozo and published a catalogue of each. He's currently editing and commenting on the poems of Francis Xavier Attard, a 20th century poet related to the professor, and has already published some of them, a 3rd volume on Kirkop, an edition of a book to be published on the occasion of St. Leonard's death and the first register of Gozo for the 16th and 17th centuries. A very warm welcome to you, Professor Vella.
Thank you very much.
Well, I was very much looking forward to this interview because I remember with great pleasure, it was a pleasure for me. I don't know whether lecturing Latin to Patricia Camilleri was very pleasurable for you.
Indeed, but it was.
But I enjoyed our four credits in basic notions of Latin very, very much indeed. So I'm very happy to meet you again. Of course, the teaching of Latin and Greek went out of fashion, in inverted commas, for some years. I think my class, which was, I did my O-level in about 1969, that dates me, of course. I suppose I was the last generation who actually did it sort of compulsory. And then after that, it sort of went out. Has it come back at all into the curriculum? Are people thinking about learning Latin now?
It has come back, but not in full force or as desired. There's no prerequisite qualification to enter university requiring Latin at all, even to study laws, for example, or theology. And so the situation is they do Latin while they do those courses here, at least theology they do. But it's still on offer as an ordinary or A-level as well, matriculation, there is also discussion at the moment of introducing yet another subject apart from Latin, Greek, and classical culture and civilization, namely a new subject such as classical studies, which would take half of the languages and half of the civilization and offer it as an intermediate subject. So I hear, at least.
Sounds promising, anyway. I remember recently one of the lecturers we have in our Department of History told me, well, it's wonderful to see that there are still students that want to study history at university. And he said, but one of the problems we have with them is very often that they've got absolutely no idea of Latin at all. And if you walk into virtually any archive that goes back more than 100 years, you're going to meet it. So sure. they have to then, as you say, learn it sort of on the job kind of thing.
Sure.
I mean, here in Malta, some of our archive is in Italian because the Knights spoke Italian between themselves.
But a lot is
Latin. A lot is also in Latin, even here.
Sure, sure. Mm.
we mentioned several things in that sort of very potted CV that we had time for. Perhaps we could just talk a little bit about each of those to show how diverse and interesting this research in Latin and Greek can be. The first thing we mentioned was the translation of a long poem, a 12th century AD poem, Greek poem, into English, which you said in your notes, which you sent me, has and will change our interpretations on Christianity in the Muslim period in Malta.
Actually, Muslim and as well Norman period as well, both periods. First of all, I'd like to say that although I translated this work, I also contributed to ideas as to the interpretation of the poem and also to notes, for example, on style and so on mythological references that there are. And that in all this, I wasn't alone, but there were two other contributors, namely Monsignor Dr. Joseph Buzzotti, who used to teach classics at this university before, and Professor Stanley Fiorini, who is much more of a historian than I am. And the three of us put our efforts together, one by transcription, myself first by translation, and then the two of us by interpretation, Professor Fiorini then with his editorship as well as his the historical background that he produced. I said earlier it is changing what we already know about Muslim and Norman Malta, in the sense that there was an idea before that during the Muslim occupation of Malta, Christianity strictly simply passed out, and then there was a new Christianization of Malta. This poem proves that this is not true, because there are various passages, in particular one of them in folio 84 verso, I think, out of a total 120 folios recto verso, so therefore 240, which refers to the liberalization of the religion. By that I mean that religion in Gozo, not in Malta, because the author was an exile in Gozo there, was practiced still, perhaps not the same situation occurred in Malta, where it was suppressed. Whereas in Gozo they were allowed to practice religion, though not with great clamor, but they had to pay a price for that by becoming second citizens and by paying a tax. And now when King Roger II came to Gozo, he liberated the Gozotans in such a way that they could now practice religion openly, and that they were no longer subject to any Arabs, and they were actually allowed to take the mosques of the Muslims and turn them into churches. And the most significant part says that they came out in jubilation at this liberalization, and that they came out with their bishop. So therefore, Gozo had its own diocese. Now, whether this diocese was different from that of Malta or not, the possibilities are two. Either that it always had its own diocese, and then it was passed on to Imdina during the Norman period, and then it lost its diocese until 1840 or something like that. Or else the diocese of Imdina, of Malta, during the Arab occupation, passed on to Gozo, because the Gozotans were allowed to practice and in Malta they were not allowed.
How much do we know about the author of the poem?
We know quite a bit, actually. He does not claim his name in the poem, but we mustn't forget that the first folios and the last folios are missing. Maybe his name was there in the first folio, but from a study done by Professor Fiorini of this poem and other poems written in Greek and in Latin by a certain Eugenius, who later on was high up in the ranks of the Norman kingdom, and he was stationed also in Germany as by the name of Eugenius, we came to the conclusion that this anonymous poet was actually a certain Eugenius, who was knowledgeable of both Latin and Greek, that he was Greek-speaking and who practiced the Byzantine rite of religion.
Another thing that you mention is the transcription of the first church register of Gozo and the completion of a study on the material transcribed. What does that exactly involve, doing this transcription?
First of all, I was commissioned to do this work by Monsignor Dr. Bezzina, who is the archivist at the Bishop's Archives, Bishop's Palace in Rabat, Gozo. I had been working on using this register, which is going back to 1554, for many, many years, because I am interested in genealogy, and so I discovered, and everybody can discover the same thing, that I have 12% of my ancestors coming from Gozo, and they all go back to this register. It's very hard reading, difficult, and so...
but and all in Latin?
All Italian and Latin, Italian and Latin. It depends upon the years, you know, sometimes a mixture, but the two languages are involved. And knowing that I was able to read it very well, and some pages are so faint that it takes a lot of time, and you have to move the book to different directions to read a single letter sometimes, you follow? I was commissioned to actually transcribe it as it appears, which I did, and before giving them a CD of my transcription, I decided to make some notes on it, you know, to make a study of it, which I am currently finishing and hope to publish in a book. So I would present the book with the CD so that in future in Gozo they can consult not the manuscript but the CD. With the facility of you type a name and you have the answer as well.
Make it much easier for everybody, won't it?
That's right. Mm-hmm.
And of course, this isn't the only register or archive that you've been working on, is it?
Yeah, no, I have transcribed all the manuscripts, the registers in the parish of Kirkop, where I live, for example. And apart from a book I produced involving all the registers, I also incorporated much of that study in my first and second volumes on Kirkop as well.
In fact, I was going to ask you about that. I mean, you're obviously very attached to Kirkop, which is where you've made your home. You've done an awful lot of work on the history
and
of Kirkop.
And I still do. The reason why I like Kirkop is, first of all, my first marriage was with a woman from Kirkop who passed away in the 1990s, and then subsequently I married again. I feel that if you don't involve yourself, if you don't make your village or town your home, then your life is not as happy. So I give the maximum to Kirkop by way of local council. I was the first mayor. Today I have a meeting with the mayor on, I don't know what about, but they want to consult me about something. And I involve myself also in the church. I am minister of the Eucharist. And I have a group which is called Emmaus, all of males, that meet and pray once a month as well.
That's wonderful. article. You've written articles on Homer and Virgil and their epics. I think one can't really interview or talk to anybody about Latin without mentioning Virgil, of course. This is a constant, you say, you refer to it as a constant search for more material to publish. There's been so much published about both. Oh, it's still possible to find new things.
It's amazing. It's amazing how, with the power of observation, you can see things in Homer and Virgil nobody ever noticed. Sometimes there's also a question of interpretation, things that were observed but interpreted differently. For example, lately I've written a paper on Helen. Everybody talks of Helen as running away with Paris. And in fact, my interpretation was that she was blinded by a goddess, Aphrodite, to run away with Paris, and that people in Troy itself, like Priam and Hector, actually pardoned Helen, and they told her, it wasn't your doing, you were compelled to do such a thing. In fact, Homer, in Book 4, presents Helen as if she was always faithful to Menelaus, her husband, as if nothing happened. Not that the thing was forgotten, because the stay at Troy is referred to, and the wooden horse and so on, you know. But to be a classicist, it's not good enough to work on local sources like manuscripts and inscriptions. You need an opening into the international world, as this university appreciates, of course, so that your articles and books may appear also outside. And so I started by taking an interest in ekphrasis. This was my speciality. Ekphrasis means when you read Homer or Virgil, you suddenly come across a passage which is given great details. For example, entering a palace and the palace is described, passing by a garden and the garden is described according to its vegetables, flowers, and herbs and so on, you know. So I've written various papers on ekphrasis. One of them was on Book 8 of Virgil's Aeneid, where the shield of Aeneas is described. So then I went on to compare the shield of Aeneas with the shield of Achilles in Homer, with the mantle of Apollonius of Rhodes, mantle of Jason in Apollonius of Rhodes, and with Achilles, with Heracles' shield in Pseudo-Hesiod, four ekphrases in one paper. Another ekphrase I discussed was the entrance to the underworld, where there is the, first of all, there is the temple of Apollo at Cumae, and then there is a description of the four panels on the door, which Daedalus had actually made, and they are described, and I produced my own interpretation of them. The ekphrasis on the Garden of Alcinous and the Palace of Alcinous in Book 7 of the Odyssey. And then I moved on to other subjects, like, for example, the Pax Romana, a bit political. And I tied it up with Malta's application to join Europe and Turkish application to join Europe, comparing the politics of Augustus and the politics of the European Union, you know, making it relevant to these days. Many other one article I'm very interested in the moment is that on the island of Trinacria, studying the itinerary of Odysseus from the Scyllan Charybdis on to further south from the Straits of Messina, passing by the, but southwards, the coast of Sicily, they come to the island of Trinacria. And so it's tempting to see what this island represented. After all, no islands are met in this Tyrrhenian Sea until you come to Malta. I was the one who challenged everybody, saying that Ogygia was never the island of Gozo. I proved it by references from Greek literature, but this time I will prove that Malta was Trinacria instead.
Oh, so we have to await that publication.
Yes. I'm very, very interested in that part.
Malta is mentioned in by classical writers
several times. Yes.
And I presume you've looked all of them.
I looked at all of them and published the findings in the Collana, produced by PIN, volume 38, which discusses Malta and Gozo in the classical era, where I gave the historic and archaeological background, but also I went on to the literature, which you refer to, and to the inscriptions as well. Originally, my interest in the inscriptions of Malta started with Gozo, when I was invited to give a paper on Gozo in ancient times, because the subject matter was Gozo, organized by Löwenbräu. After that, I was invited to contribute to the same, but to Malta, and so the two were put together. That is good.
What about the poems that you mentioned also of Francis Xavier Attard? I believe he was your great-grandfather.
That's right. He was I don't remember him, but he was the father of the grandmother I remember, who was the mother of my mother. So the father of the mother of my mother, on the maternal side. He worked as a blacksmith, and he was good at it, apparently, judging from the fact that it is not known that in those ancient times, I'm talking about early part of the 20th century, that he could produce the lock and the box together, that is, keys, the big metal keys in those days. He was able to produce also the box and not just the key, you see. At the same time, he liked to converse with advocates, with priests, especially on a Sunday, and he knew Latin as well, judging from the same poems and from tradition within the family, circus. Somebody told me he had originally intended to become a monk, so he had to learn Latin. You follow?
I was going to say, a blacksmith knowing Latin wouldn't have been the norm, I suppose, time.
And the poems that I have collected, which count to 15, but he wrote much more, which are now lost, I have started to analyze them, and having given much attention to prosody in my PhD dissertation, to this 2 meter, I'm able to study the prosody of these poems, and I can say that he knew also of Latin poems, the way they were divided into iambic meter or trochaic meter or dactylic, from the beat he used. He didn't use one beat for all the poems, but he changed according to poem.
And what was the subject matter of the poem?
Generally, because he came from Nashar, and so they were like small poems dedicated to the nativity of Our Lady, the patron saint of Nashar. But there are others like to St. Paul of Safi, to St. John the Baptist of Shaukia Gozo, and also lately one to the band of St. Julian's, which I published last year.
That's lovely. So a bit of social history as well.
Yes. And I have gone through the various people that are mentioned in these poems, giving genealogical findings about them.
And talking of genealogy, you said it's one of your sort of little interests. How is that developing?
Well, I started my interest in genealogy by accident. My uncle, my father's husband, said, probably not joking, that we are of German origin, because he said, Vella, written as Wella, the ones that produce chemicals on hair, pigmentation and so on, were Germans. And so I started to do research in 1996. All I have done, it's practically complete now, is simply multiplying by two every grandfather. In other words, if my parents are two, then my grandparents are four, great-grandparents are eight, and so I kept on increasing all information ad infinitum, that is. In the year 2000, I decided to contribute to the millennium, you know. Apart from a book on Kirkhope, I decided to something like a masterpiece, I like to call it. I have a room upstairs in my house at Kirkhope, which is very spacious, the biggest room in the house, where I put a ceiling there, and I put all, not everyone, but those that the ceiling could bear, all the names of the ancestors of my son, that is from my side and from my wife's side. My son is called Jerome, so I put him at the center of the ceiling, on top of the chandelabra, that is, and around him rotate the parents, grandparents, great-grandparents, and so on, and they cover every part of the ceiling. So when the child sleeps there, he can see the blessings coming down from all his ancestors, and that's where I came from, and I dropped down here, sort of.
That sounds excellent. Well, your son is obviously going to have a sense of history from this lovely ceiling that you've built for him.
I call it the first genealogical ceiling.
Well, thank you very, very much, Professor Wella, coming to the studio today to talk to us about your research in Latin and Greek. It was a fascinating journey. Thank you very, very much for being here. My guest today was Professor Horatio Wella. I do hope that you'll be able to join me again next week for another edition of Research Matters. This is Patricia Camilleri saying goodbye.